Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by Yano Faflik. And Yano is a deep tech venture capitalist at Tensor Ventures, where he champions startups with 100x growth potential in tech bio, crypto, and deep tech. A techno-optimist and Xtropian, Yano brings a keen eye for innovation to his role, identifying groundbreaking technologies in fields like AI, biotech, and quantum computing. With a background in bioinformatics and hands-on experience in computational chemistry, he combines technical expertise with a passion for future-forward solutions. At Tensor Ventures, Yano supports visionary founders in building the next wave of transformative tech, helping them navigate the journey from startup to scalable success. I've asked him to join us here today to share his story and insights into the future. So, Yano, thank you so much for joining us, my friend. How you doing?
Good. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me
Yeah, it's good to have
today.
you here. Yeah. And before we hop into the future of things and business, how did you even get involved in venture capital and these innovative fields? Like part of the family business? Do you come from a family of venture capitalists, or is your family programmers and in these fields?
No, not at all. Actually, I'm coming from a working class family, blue collar people, and I was just always really interested in science, and I was a sci-fi nerd, I think. But yeah, I was from when I can remember, I always read a lot of books and was interested in the future, basically. When I've gotten the chance, I have gotten a lot of internships in different scientific institutes and in labs. So I have learned a lot there from the time I was 15, I think. From basically my childhood, I was always wanting to do something exciting that helps to build the future. And yeah, and then
You said you got started at 15. You said you got started at 15. You were doing internships and working in a lab at 15.
yeah, I was, as I said, I was really lucky to do that. But there was a small lab in our hometown that was doing something around optimizing production of some chemicals used in the pharma industry. When I was hired during the summer as a lab assistant, and I was doing everything from cleaning the labware and just helping around and learning as much as I can. So I was really lucky to have that experience from an early age.
So what did you do after that? That's at 15, you're getting started, you're already in a lab, you're learning
Yeah.
what's happening now. What'd you do next?
Yeah, after that, I was still going to school, but I used that experience to get an internship at a bigger lab that was based here in Prague, not in my hometown. There, I did some research in computational chemistry, basically simulations of how different molecules bind and how that could be useful for designing new drugs. And I learned coding through that. I learned coding in Python and Bash. So I, again, got an early exposure to that. And it was a nice experience. I'm not from a big city, so it was my first time going somewhere alone to let's say a bigger city.
Freedom and getting paid too at the same time, right?
Yeah.
The good
Yeah,
life.
yeah, yeah.
Got it. So, computational chemistry. So, you're looking, so you said simulations on how molecules and things can combine to form drug. How accurate is that stuff? How often does the computer prove valid in real life?
I think it's based on quantum mechanics, so it's not like it wouldn't be sometimes inaccurate, but you are basically trying to estimate the probabilities that something happens because quantum mechanics isn't absolute, it's
Probability.
probabilistic. So you are estimating the probabilities and you have different accuracy of those estimations. But you can never say something for 100% certainty, but different kinds of calculations can give you different kind of accuracy of your estimates. And what we were doing was probably some of the most complex calculations that were need to be run on large computational clusters. It's a method called the density functional theory, where it basically calculates certain properties of the molecules from the electron density of a given molecule. So it's a complex quantum physics, quantum chemistry stuff.
Yeah, I love it. So is it a fair oversimplification to say that in quantum computing, like you said, it's probabilistic. So it's how probable something is to happen, which means that when you ask it about something, all possible answers are basically all like all possible computations are calculated, and then it's condensed into the strongest signal, almost like a signal to noise type thing. That's fair to say, yeah.
Definitely. I definitely agree. I think this is one of my favorite analogies actually about quantum computing, because if you believe in the multiverse theory of quantum physics, then you can basically say that quantum computer calculates the given thing once in each of those universes, and then just picks the solution from the universe where the calculation came to the right conclusion. That's the way how to look at that.
It is, and we can go on that tangent for a minute. And so I read a book by David Deutsch, The Beginning of Infinity, and in it he talks about different, like you could have, maybe you take a trip somewhere, and then all the different things that can happen on the trip happen, but at the end there's some almost like an event horizon or like a singularity where everything collapses into a specific event, and that event is the bridge between forks in the road. If people, it's if there's only one entry and one exit to a town, but in that town you can go all over, do whatever you want. That's the multiverse and the idea of multiple timelines and how they all collapse into one, and this decision into that. And that's there's some real deep philosophical questions that quantum computing addresses. So you're in cutting edge stuff. How old are you when you're dealing? You're working with a quantum computer at what age now?
We weren't working with a quantum computer, but we were running quantum simulations on a classic computer. And I was, I think,
Ah,
18 years.
yeah, okay. But you're, yeah, okay. But still, you're like, yeah, you're 18 years old, you're cutting edge. That's fantastic. So, how does that lead into business?
Yeah, so then I again by chance I was looking to get some other internship and exposure to some other fields, because I was thinking that it's good to not just do science, but also maybe understand how to commercialize science and how to do business in terms of how can you actually research something and then turn it into a product that people can use. And I have by a chance I have found internship in a family office based in Prague. And I got a chance to work in their biotech venture capital team. So I was working there for 4 months as an intern. And later on, I have gotten an offer to work there as a part-time investment analyst. So I worked at their team investing into different biotech startups. And they also had some public biotech positions, so we helped with analyzing those positions as well.
All right. So I have a personal goal to live to be 300. I'm 41 now. Do you think I'm going to hit that goal? Is that, since you're looking at stuff today that may not become mainstream for 20 years, whatever, do you think, what are my odds? What's my probability of making it to be 300? Come on. Come on, Janos. Give me some good news. What
I think it's speculative, but to
are
say it best.
we at? Not what I want to hear, Yano. I want to hear, Daryl, I'm going to FedEx something to your house. Just drink it. No, I'm kidding. I got it. No, it's fine. It's fine. So that's exciting. What do you feel? Are there, listen, everybody's excited about things. Everyone's excited about AI, all that stuff. Personally, I feel like when you really get into the nuts and bolts, sometimes small changes can have a huge impact, but it's still just a small change. And so what I mean by that is, what's happening in these fields right now, is it lots of small changes that maybe have big impacts, or are we making massive changes? That might sound like a weird question, but.
But I think I get it. I think it matters on the field and it matters on the given change. I think there are sometimes some changes. For example, if you look at AI, you had the ChatGPT moment, which even though wasn't a huge improvement in the technology because you had GPT-3 before, but somehow it triggered the whole industry and it triggered a lot of other people to look into it, because now it had a nice user interface and you could interact with it as a chatbot. Even though it might be like technically incremental progress, it was a huge step forward for the
User
whole
adoption.
area, adaption. And that's, for example, that's what happened in AI. And now I think we have a lot of incremental progress again, but it's going at a faster pace than before, just because a lot of money is going to the area. In like other areas, I don't think, like in quantum computing, for example, it's still a lot of it is still basic research. None of of currently available quantum computers are actually fully working at a large scale. So that's still area that's in the beginnings. In biotech, I think that's established industry. and you have a good progress at different for designing different drugs to treat diseases, but no like super huge breakthroughs. I think since CRISPR, I think that was something that, you know, pushed the industry forward and allowed new genetic engineering and other level that wasn't available before. But all of the fruits of the discovery still hasn't reached the clinic fully. I think there's still like a lot of stuff that will be done just from the first generation of, you know, CRISPR technologies, because it takes a long time to before they can actually reach patients because of clinical trials and regulation. So there, even though you had the kind of ChatGPT moment, the time to actually reach users or like the end patients is much longer because of regulation. So all different industries are different, but this stuff is happening everywhere.
I think that's a great. So for people that we talk about, blue collar people or just small business owners that might be listening to this, are there any skills or behaviors that you think they need to have or develop or be aware of in order to, I'm saying, like, I don't know if the dry cleaner's got to worry about GPT too much, right? I don't know if your roofer has to worry about ChatGPT too much, but they may have to worry about the Tesla bot. And so then they may need to focus more on building the business. I'm not trying to give you the answer, but I'm trying to form the question. If Tesla bots are real and that's a real thing, then maybe if I'm a roofer, I have to look at, how do I hire one or two, and how do I set up my company knowing that they're going to get better and focus more on building better roofs and reaching more customers and training staff to maintain the, that's my question for you. What kind of skills and behaviors do you think, are there any trends that people aren't aware of that are coming down the pipeline? Or maybe you don't know what people aren't aware of, but I think you get what I'm saying.
Yeah, definitely agree that general business skills, as you mentioned, will be super useful even in the age of AI and automation, because actually AI and maybe robots will allow you to have a few person companies that are huge, or maybe one person companies that are huge. So it will allow everyone to basically start their own business without a lot of employees and do something interesting. So the positive scenario for AI is that 1,000 flowers will bloom and everything will be good. But also at the same time, I think there are some problems. It might replace jobs and take jobs from some percentage of the population. And so those people that might get affected should learn to be flexible, should try to pursue new fields, be curious about them, and not just sleep on it. I don't know if there are some concrete skills that I can highlight you and that would work for everyone, except maybe those general business skills. But yeah, other than that, I think it matters on given situation of given person always. But being flexible and looking to learn new stuff and not just sleeping on it can give you an advantage from if you have any kind of background, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, like you said, the general business skills, which is more, first, you did say there's one, continuous learning. I think that it's more important than ever. We both have a mutual, I don't know if he's a friend, but Brian Johnson, a guy that spent a couple of million, stay healthy throughout all this. That's really important, because a lot of change is going to come. We got to stay healthy as long as we can, because developments, like you say, are coming faster than before. Research, everything's speeding up. So you got to stay learning. You have to stay as healthy as you can, as healthy as possible, mentally, physically. And we talk about general business skills. To me, that's things like working on your flaws, on being a better person, because a lot of businesses that I've worked with, I always say, I feel like business is very Shakespearean, meaning that in all of Shakespeare's plays, the main characters fell victim to their greatest flaw and they never worked on it. And I feel so many business owners, they fall victim to their greatest flaw. And so you really have to work on developing yourself. And then you say general business skills is learning how to organize, project manage, identify market trends, connect with people, all that sort of stuff, I think and it just fits into continuous learning and being healthy. I think those are really good sort of fields. What's some of the most exciting stuff that you're excited about?
A lot of things around technology, since we are investing in it. So as I said, there are advancements in many new fields, including AI, but that's a little bit overhyped right now. But what excites me, I think the AI, it's stuff like clones of humans. I think that's a new area that's still a little bit unexplored, still not fully built out. But
Did you say human clones?
yeah, like digital human clones, not like
Oh, I thought
clones.
you meant
Yeah.
real. Because there's
So,
a Clonaid. Is it Clonaid? Yeah, Clonaid. You can go to clonaid.com. This site copyright was 2006, 2009. The site's still up. They're the first ones that came out. They said they had Eve. You can find videos of this on Twitter and stuff. They said they were cloning people in 2006, 2007, that they had done this, and then they just disappeared somewhere. But their site still accepts, like, the contact us form still works, and apparently the copyright was 2006, 2007. What's up with
Okay.
that? I'm not trying to go down a rabbit hole here, but I thought you said human cloning.
If you were to talk about your own biological human cloning, that I think it works. I think it works in monkeys, it works in sheep and other things. It haven't been done in humans because of the ethical and regulatory
Well,
reasons,
they
but
say it hasn't been done.
yeah.
And there
And
are
we can.
chimeras. China's had some human hybrid chimeras or something. There's been
Yeah, but they haven't grown them outside of the embryo stage. So
that
they
we know
usually,
of.
yeah, that we know of. Yeah. But yeah, human cloning is an interesting kind of ethical area. I don't think it's there is going to be something in the next at least 5 years because of just the regulatory environment. But in the long term, you could imagine growing organs, maybe not in full human body, but just growing organs separately outside of human body. And or stuff like organ engineering is going to be huge, I think, in maybe next not 5 years, but 10 years or 15 years, because the whole kind of replacement of organs is a huge undertaking that
Right.
right now we don't really can't really do efficiently.
It's a
There are
really
long
ugly process
way
right
to
now. It involves
yeah.
aborted babies and wounded people, and it's just not a pretty market at all. And it is such a profitable, it is insanely profitable because of, as a result of that. So if you could just grow one like in a food tray type thing, that would, in a petri dish, that would be
Great.
huge. Yeah. Is there anything else happening that you, in terms of biotech right now, that you're keenly, like, what are you following?
In terms of biotech, I'm looking a lot into neurodegenerative. So a lot of the area, for example, diseases as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, and in general, brain. There, I think there's going to be a lot of stuff happening around neuroscience in general because it's one of those one of the few still least studied scientific areas. And there are huge kind of problems, as I said, Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. I think Alzheimer's is currently one of the most costly diseases worldwide. It costs around $1 trillion USD each year, the whole world. So it's a huge problem. Still hasn't been solved, and I think there is a lot of interest from pharma companies in this area. So startups in biotech that are trying to solve this or trying to do diagnostics in neurodegenerative diseases and stuff like that are super interesting. And that's one area of biotech I'm following quite closely. Yeah.
And what about with crypto? Are we, I'm just going to put my opinion out there. Are we throwing off the shackles of archaic monetary systems and banking cartels that have been keeping people poor and funding both sides of wars? Do you feel that? Maybe I'm wrong in my assessment, but I feel like that's what's happening. Do you feel that there's progress being made on that? Because obviously there's a back and forth with regulation. There's the Bitcoin proponents and the antagonist. And what's your take on the crypto space? And is that, you talk about
Yeah,
the speed to market, or, yeah, sorry.
I agree. I think there are two main kind of parts of crypto. One is just the Bitcoin and the Bitcoin kind of people and Bitcoin maximalists and the whole kind of tribe around it. And I think those are probably never going to be regulated, and they are on the kind of libertarian side of things and having a strong political issues and stuff like that. And then you have the kind of more tech industry like crypto, Ethereum, Solana, and the other chains that you can probably meet at a conference in Singapore, and it's quite similar to, I think, to the tech industry, even though they are a little bit more decentralized in the tech industry. But those parts of crypto, I think, should and in the future will work more with regulators, and because they want, in the end, they want mass adoptions by normal people. Not just crypto nerds. So they will need to work with regulators, and I think they are currently trying to work with regulators and also They are actually one of the most strongest forces in, let's say, U.S. elections right now as well. If you are following that, all of the candidates are trying to be pro-crypto, and I think crypto people are donating a high percentage of the corporate donations to political candidates in the U.S. So they are going to be a force in the next few years to the whole crypto community, and I think the technology there is fundamentally real. But they have different cycles, they have bubbles and they pop, and there are a lot of noise in the whole ecosystem. But some of the use cases, such as stable coins and stuff like that, are here already. They have product market fit and have real users. They are here to stay, but not everything from the ecosystem will stay because it's such a dynamic and bubbly.
Yeah.
So.
I have a buddy. He manages the first legal crypto fund in Mexico. I think he's got a couple million under management. And he was telling me it's just a big casino at this point. And that people have it's all just meme coins, but there's just different tech that gives people justification for investing in it. And right now, there's just not, there, like you said, the stable coins and some of the things, they're there, but they're there already. And a lot of these other projects, they haven't materialized into anything tangible yet. And it's just the potential is giving people excuses to throw money at it. So there's something there. It's almost like the dot-com bubble. It allowed us to wire the world. So it was a lot, there was bubbles that popped. So sounds like that's what's happening with crypto. And in the meantime, just invest in Bitcoin. I'm a pro Bitcoin person. The tech in terms of using it, because it's still the user friendliness of crypto is still really confusing for a lot of people. Even if somebody wants to buy Bitcoin, they need the seed phrase, and I got to write this 4,700 number code down, and I got to keep it somewhere and not forget it because then my life savings are gone and I'll never recover it. What's happening with that and making that more user friendly? Is there anything you're aware of that's making this something to more? There's apps you can download. I've been locked out of apps because I moved countries and my credit card expired and I couldn't change the app store country. And now I'm locked out of banking apps and stuff. Do you know what I'm saying? Is there anything happening?
I'm not sure if there is a solution. I think that the community in general is trying to build more user-friendly apps, and there are different new hardware wallets and stuff like that. And it is becoming more user-friendly with every generation. But I don't feel like there's a definitive solution to the user experience problem of trying to keeping it maximum security and
Security,
etc.
yeah.
At the same time, having a nice user experience, I think that's a hard problem that nobody still has fully solved.
Yeah. And for people that aren't aware, the issue is because as it is, Bitcoin is incredibly secure right now in that. But the problem is to make a layer on top of that more user friendly creates a weakness in the chain of the system. And so inherently, you do anything to make it more user friendly, there's you're just piling layer upon layer upon layer of protocol essentially on top. And then is it the secure thing that we all thought it was? Because there's back doors. There's oh, and the thing, I forget his name, but the guy from Ethereum let it slip. Maybe this is the last year newsflash, but he let it slip that there's a back door to Ethereum that they use sometimes to make dev updates. People are like, what do you mean there's a back door? There's all these, yeah. If you can't see the video, Yano's nodding. Yeah, people are putting their life savings on this stuff. It sounds like you just have to learn and you got to get a tattoo that means something to you and nobody else. And that's what you do, because for those that don't know, with crypto and Bitcoin and that, this is essentially no bank, no account, no nothing. You can open up and you remember your seed phrase, you've got your account number, we'll call it that, and you can basically go any computer anywhere and log in and access your funds anywhere and process a transaction. The best stuff to use is always open source because the code can be verified by the community, and that's, I think, an important one as well. Is there any other tips you think for helping people adopt crypto better? I'm just trying to think of what might be useful to the listener.
Honestly, just to be curious and try to get involved in the local ecosystem that they are, because I think right now in every country you have some, or nearly every country you have some Bitcoin groups, you probably have some crypto conferences. So the best way how to start is to go to one of those events and just talk with the people there and get involved with the community, and they'll everything best way to do it. That's how I did it.
No, fair enough. Just dive in. You learn more from doing than just meditating on it. So I think that's powerful. How, as an analyst, so one of the things you said to me I thought was brilliant. So we met at a conference, and one of the things you said to me I thought was brilliant was that if you had a fund and you got $50 million to invest, you're looking for 50 to 100 or more projects that you can invest in where each one has the potential to bring back the full fund. So each one has a potential to make 50 million. And so you're trying to place as many bets as you can to make 50 million. How do you analyze a business opportunity as an analyst? It's like me asking you to predict what's going to happen 20 years from now, essentially, because this stuff, what's the timeline for this to manifest, right? So can you maybe walk listeners through the process of how do you assess and evaluate an opportunity?
So the timeline for us is 10 years. Just to be clear, the fund has 10 years horizon, so we need to return the money in 10 years. And the way how we evaluate projects, it matters on their stage, and we invest in pre-seed and seed. So two different stages. In pre-seed, the projects are really at the beginning. It's usually just a team with some idea, maybe a prototype or something like that. So at that stage, we try to work a lot with the team, have a few meetings with them, discuss a lot of their plans with them, challenge them on different topics, see how they react to being challenged, and in general, trying to get to know the team as much as possible, know their background, know the founding story, the motivation, if they are ambitious enough. So we are basically trying to find the person that knows how to build the thing that they're actually saying they will build, and also is ambitious enough to build a huge thing and not just build a small company, but try to build a huge company from the get-go, because there's like a different philosophical approach to that. So that's on the people part. And then we do a lot of due diligence around markets the companies are targeting. So we are really trying to understand not just the numbers as time SAM and then different market sizes as everybody has in their pitch decks, but we really try to understand how big is maybe the smallest market that the company can target. That's how we look at it. So I usually try to look at the initial market the company is doing, the kind of the worst case scenario if the company just get stuck to the initial market, and is that big enough basically. So I'm trying to think about, even if in the worst case, is that market over $1 billion, and can the company get some reasonable market share in that? And so that's how we look at markets. And then since we are a deep tech investor, we do a lot of due diligence around the technology, because as I said, usually come with a prototype or it's an academic spin-off. So we can actually read some scientific papers and stuff like that and try to analyze if we actually believe it works. If there's some scientific risk involved, we need to try to understand what's the scientific risk, how big it is, and if it's actually realistic to do the project. So if it's just sci-fi, because even though if we would sometimes like to, we can't invest in sci-fi. Yeah. So those are the main things: the people, the market, and the technology. Yeah.
That's a good breakdown. The people, which is the people that are going to be running and building the company, the market, and you're trying to assess the smallest viable segment that you think, and that's worst case scenario. So you maybe do like the Goldilocks three bear, too hot, too cold, just, and then the technology. Do you do a lot of looking at any of the competitors and stuff? Is that kind of lumped in with market? You're looking
Yeah,
at.
that's part of the market due diligence. We do look at competitors.
And when you look at a competitor, are you just going to their website or do you guys go buy their stuff? How do you?
Usually it's just a website, and sometimes it's getting introductions to those people and talking with them actually, but usually it's just a website. And a lot of times actually competitors aren't like a negative sign. If there are some competitors, it's not like too much crowded space, and if they have some traction, it can show you maybe it's a big space, there's enough room for two to three companies to be big there, and maybe you have some cool technology that the competitors don't have, and then why not do that? But if it's a super crowded space, you have tons of small companies trying to do the same thing as you are, then usually I think we wouldn't invest, just because we would have to have a really strong belief in the founder or the technology that it's really light years away from everyone else to invest into a fully crowded space.
So, trying to formulate my next question about this. How long does it take for you to do that assessment? Some people are running businesses for years and they don't even realize they're in a sinking ship. How long does it take you guys to do? Is it because you have special tools or something? Like, how long does it take and what are some of the tools that you typically use?
Yeah, so we usually try to do the due diligence, the full kind of investment process in in 2 to 3 months. We need to be quick because the investments rounds are competitive too. So to get to the best deals, you need to make decisions quickly. And sometimes you need to make them quicker and not go through the whole process just because you like the company and it's a really competitive round. So sometimes you need to be even quicker than that. But usually it's 2 to 3 months. And in terms of the tools we use, we have different databases that can help us search for competitors and understand the markets. So, for example, Crunchbase, we use Spectra, which is an AI scouting tool, which has helps us find competitors and scout new startups. And so, yeah, so different software tools. And yeah, that's the main thing. And then just Googling and being curious, reading a lot, talking a lot with the people, just doing the work that you need to do to really understand a given thing.
And I guess when you think about a $1 billion company, how are you evaluating the $1 billion? Is it just in top line revenue, or are you looking at the value of things like licenses, real estate, equipment, patents, copyrights, like you mentioned, intellectual property like technology? Does that go into the
So we wouldn't do a complicated, some kind of a complicated DCF valuation just because we are investing so early. So when we invest into companies, they usually aren't at the billion valuation that they are maybe a 5 to $10 million USD range as a valuation. But in terms of the future outlook, if the company has a big vision that can change a lot and the initial market is large enough, then we usually believe that it's big enough for us.
Got it.
So
So,
there isn't like some complicated financial model or anything like that. It's
but
because that's just.
they're already doing 5 to 10 million already. So they've already got proof of concept, product market fit, but they're going somewhere, it sounds
Yeah,
like.
they are not doing 5 to 10 million in revenue. That's the valuation that we give them. We usually invest, we invest even earlier than that. 5 to 10 million in revenue is a company that could be valued at, I don't know, 50 to maybe 100 million, like a valuation, like a market cap. But we invest at a market cap of 5 to 10 million, basically. So really,
Got it. Okay. So very early stage, big vision, large market. I think that's really important, really powerful. One of the things I want to ask is, what are some of, you see so many of these businesses, you see which ones pan out, which ones don't. What do you think are some of the critical success factors? Maybe you already said it, but to really hit it on the head.
Yeah, I think again, the team is probably the most important thing. If you have a good or if you have a great team with an okay idea, it's better to invest than in a bad team or okay team with a great idea. The team matters more than the market and a lot of times than the technology. It's just their ability to sell, their ability to actually execute and deliver results. And also pivot when things are not going great is the most important thing in the end. Because as I said, the startups, the companies are sometimes changing their directions and sometimes they are pivoting. So it can happen that you are going to invest and in a year the company is going to do something else than you originally projected. But if you have a good team, then the other thing is probably going to be big as well. And it's going to be meaningful as well, and it still can be a huge company. So team is probably the most important thing in the end. In terms of maybe covering your downside, I think then technology and possibly intellectual property can play a big role, because if you are investing in some of these companies fail, it's venture capital. A lot of companies we invest into fails, even though we don't like to see it, but they do. But if you invest into deep tech companies that have IP and that actually have developed some technology, you can at least sell the technology and I don't know if make some return or at least get your money back. So that's a little bit of a downside protection for us. It's one of the reasons why we invest in deep tech, because you usually have some real concrete thing that you can out-license or sell to some big
Somebody
corporation.
else. Right. Is there any sort of support or training? If you've got someone and maybe they're just an inventor and they don't know anything about business, what sort of support do you guys provide to try to help them understand how to run a business or develop the skills that they need? Is it mostly trying to hire people that are already good? So you've got a core team, but the core people are, they're really good at deep tech. And now we need to get some sales professionals in here. And so you're just looking to hire veterans to move in. And so you're not really training anybody about anything. You're just trying to put butts in seats and hope the group dynamics work out. Is that a rough eyeball of what how things run or?
We also definitely help with hiring. We can hire technical people and business people as well. So we do help with hiring. We also help with business development and introductions, not in every areas, but I think we have as a fund, we have a good network in the semiconductors industry and in, let's say, computing infrastructure. So we know people from NVIDIA, Intel, AMD, AWS, Azure, different clouds providers and stuff like that. So we do help a lot with introductions to those. And in general, we try to help with business developments of those companies. Actually, one of our general partners is dedicating like half of his time to just help with business development with different companies, making intros, helping them with their sales strategy and stuff like that. So we are quite hands-on and like to be involved. At the same, if the given founder actually needs it, not every founder needs our help. If they don't, then we don't necessarily try to force ourselves somewhere where it's not necessary.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, no, this has been a great call. I've had so much fun asking some of this stuff and going down some of these rabbit holes. Is there anything I haven't asked you about that I should have asked you about?
I don't know. I think we covered a lot, everything from science to venture capital and startups. So I think we talk about all of the topics that I expected people.
Sure. And if people want to learn more, if they want to get in touch, or if they think they have something worth throwing under your nose, what are some of the best ways for them to get in contact?
So I think I have LinkedIn or Twitter. So you can find me at I think LinkedIn is probably the best one for me. And there just DM me or I have my email in my profile info. So you can send me a mail with a pitch deck or something like that. So that those probably is the best way to contact me.
So you can find Jano Faflik, Faflik, and his first name is spelled Jan, but it's pronounced Jano. So if you got Jan Faflik, he's working with Deep Tech VC, or he's a Deep Tech VC at Tensor Ventures. We got the right one. Double check, make sure he's in Prague. Again, that's Jan Faflik. Jano, it's been an honor and a pleasure, both just following each other around at the conference and catching up afterwards and having you come here and letting you pick my brain. Thank you so much for coming and sharing with my audience and I, knowing that you've got your own followers, your own companies, your own stuff to take care of. Thank you for coming and sharing with all of us so we can all do a little bit better.
Thank you as well. It was really a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.